I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Major support for Classical Music Connection is provided by Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the August 2021 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, Simon Hayes checks the origins of J.S. Bach's Brandenburg Concertos. The Brandenburg Concertos makes for one of the greatest musical CVs ever assembled. In 1721, Bach dedicated his score in flowery French to Christian Ludwig, Margrave of Brandenburg, not in fulfillment of a commission, but more as a thinly disguised application for employment at the Margrave's court. Quote, "In taking leave of your Royal Highness," wrote Bach, "you were willing to do me the honor of commanding me to send you some pieces of my composition." The title Brandenburg Concertos was dreamed up in the 19th century by Bach's first biographer, but in fact the six concertos were never conceived as a set, nor intended specifically for the Margrave. Bach selected them from his back catalogue of works written while Kapellmeister at the court of Köthen. That was 1717-23. Their wide-ranging instrumentation and virtuoso demands were designed to showcase Curtin's outstanding instrumentalists, whose talents seem to have spurred Bach on to explore the potential of the concerto form itself, which he reinvented with each new work. In the BBC Music Magazine for July of 2022, we get to interview rising star conductor Harry Seaver. Where were you born? London, UK. What would be your career highlight so far? Bizet's Carmen at Opera North this season, a beautiful production with a great cast. Working with touring companies is brilliant. You always hope there's someone in the audience experiencing the thrill of music for the first time. Who is your musical hero? Claudio Abbado's recordings are so fresh and vibrant. He encouraged a sense of making chamber music. He had humility and respect for the musicians, but also creativity and playfulness. What would be your dream concert? Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, staged with contemporary dancers. I love interdisciplinary collaboration. There's so much we can learn from one another. In the BBC Music Magazine for August of 2022, Michael Church discusses Leif Ove Andsnes's new Mozart project. Our story begins with a 14-year-old Norwegian boy making his debut with a professional orchestra in Mozart's D minor piano concerto K-466. The experience, he recalls, took him aback. "It was a shock to have all this sound so closely around me. It scared me." Fast forward to 2007, and he was recording the same piece with the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra. Though when he listens now to that recording, he isn't impressed. "What I was doing and what the orchestra was doing didn't cohere enough. My playing was flashy, going for effects rather than integrating itself into a bigger drama." Fast forward once more to today, and the ruthlessly self-critical Leif Ove Andsnes has recorded this work yet again, and is going to direct it from the keyboard at the proms. He's also making it the centerpiece for a multifaceted project entitled Mozart Momentum, whose origins lie in a similar project, which he dubbed the Beethoven Journey, and which had its own offbeat genesis. Ansnes had been staying in a hotel in Brazil where the lifts played snatches of Beethoven's first and second piano concertos, and at first he thought it would drive him mad. "But the more I listened," he tells me on Zoom, "the more I loved hearing short fragments of pieces that are so familiar that we take them for granted. I fell in love again with this music." So in tandem with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, he devised a journey which would take the concertos, plus some sonatas and chamber works, on a tour covering 55 cities in 22 countries. For a performer used to spreading his musical net promiscuously, the project came as a relief. It was liberating to have only one style, one musical language to work in. And it taught me how far you could go with one ensemble if you work as intensely as I was doing with the MCO. You had the feeling that everybody was striving for the same common goal. If you play with that multinational orchestra, you have to accept their lifestyle. Because they don't have a geographical base, they are constantly touring. They make their decisions communally. And that's why every member feels responsibility for the outcome. The orchestra's leader is Matthew Truscott, whose professionalism Ansnes praises to the skies. "When he joined the project, everything came together in a way it hadn't before." Truscott reciprocates that admiration. "Despite his eminence, Leif Ove makes it clear that in his view, we are all equals. His clarity of vision and the intensity and refinement of his playing all sets a wonderful tone for the ensemble to follow." The Beethoven Project has now given rise to a project devoted to Mozart, though that composer was not one of Ansnes' early loves. "I played him as a child, but by the time I'd become a student, I wasn't interested in his music. I preferred the physicality, the virtuosity of 19th century pianism. It took me a while to realize that Mozart's music was operatic and theatrical through and through. Only in my 30s did I realize his music was all about conversation, human nature, and society." Ansnes can't think of any other music which so satisfyingly ticks those boxes. He's chosen to focus on the music Mozart wrote in 1785-86, including chamber music and even some music for the Masonic rituals so dear to Mozart's heart. After his historic duel with Clementi, Mozart had established himself as the finest keyboard player in Vienna, and settling in that city, thus asserting his independence from his father, he went into creative overdrive, writing 6 piano concertos in 1784. These were the years of his short but successful period as an impresario, in which he exploited every avenue to publicize and monetize his work. He greatly increased the number of concerts featuring himself as composer and soloist, thus reaping maximum profits. He gave subscription concerts in unconventional venues and frequently performed in aristocratic salons. "I must play new works, and therefore I must compose," he wrote excitedly to his father. The whole morning is taken up with pupils, and almost every evening I have to play. As Ansnes points out, this period saw Mozart's style developing as rapidly as his productivity. From the concerto in D minor onwards, there's something special happening. This is music with a newly dramatic character, with new ideas about how to distribute material between the soloist and the orchestra. The convention had always been that the pianist would simply repeat and elaborate what the orchestra had played at the start. But when I come in as soloist, I have completely different music from what the orchestra has played. Mozart must have realized he was on to something interesting here. This represented a new kind of independence for the soloist, which Beethoven loved. He not only played this concerto, he also wrote a cadenza for it. The andante of the next concerto, number 21, best known for furnishing the heart-tugging score for Bo Widerberg's film Elvira Madigan, uses muted upper strings and plucked lower ones to create a breathtaking stillness, which for Ansnes is pervaded by ambiguity. It really is theater, strange stories, and crocodile tears. The emotional world is ambiguous, and we are constantly being told different things. For Ansnes, this ambiguity is the keynote for all five of the concertos from this period, most notably the andante of the A minor, number 23. It has this absolute darkness to it, and at the same time a healing power. The cadenzas he's chosen come from Beethoven, Hummel, and recent heroes including Dino Labati and Geza Anda, but one is by a certain John Fraser, who just happens to be his producer. How come? Ansnes laughs. I told him that for the E-flat work I didn't have a cadenza I felt comfortable with, or which I really liked. As John is also a pianist, he said, I'll give it a go. A few weeks later, he came up with a wonderful draft. I added a few suggestions, but basically it's his, and it beautifully launches the orchestra at the end. Yet this project almost didn't happen at all. As things were getting into gear, Ansnes was suddenly hospitalized with pneumonia. It was like a prophecy of the pandemic to come, he says. And when it did come, it wrought havoc with their plans. Three large tours were canceled. The miracle was that in the middle of the lockdown in 2020, as Europe was on the verge of being totally immobilized, Ansnes and the orchestra managed to give several concerts and make two large recordings. We got everybody to Berlin for 4 days, and everyone was masked and kept their distance on stage. It was challenging at first, but the orchestra adapted fast, and we found people could hear each other very well. For the recordings, he says, the mic'd sound was excellent, though for the concerts the results were inevitably not so good. I hope the joy we felt while making the recordings will come over to the listeners. What are the pros and cons of directing from the keyboard? The pros are that we hear each other very well, especially with me playing without a lid. It's wonderful to hear and see each other so closely. He instances the end of the last movement of Beethoven's first piano concerto, where the winds have recklessly fast material, and the piano has rapid scales up and down, and everything has to go like clockwork. That's always a problem when I have a conductor and I'm sitting in the normal soloist position. But when I play that work sitting in the middle of the orchestra, there's no problem and everything is automatically solved. The other benefit when I'm leading from the keyboard is that I'm always in the flow of the music. It's not like I'm switched on and off, waiting for my turn doing it, then sitting back again to let the orchestra have their turn. On the other hand, since I'm doing two things at once, I have to make sure that I'm not sacrificing the details of my playing. Lee Fauvé-Ansnes may be 52, and he may be a supreme perfectionist, but he's willingly spent his whole adult life under the close tutelage of a shadowy figure whose recent death he mourns. "Jacques de Thiers was an extraordinary man," he says. "I met him after I had given a recital in Amsterdam, which had very, diverse reactions from the critics. And he defended me and asked to meet me. And for a couple of years he came to my concerts as though he was simply a fan. Finally, I said, 'Put your cards on the table.' And he said, 'If you want to work with me, maybe I can help.' That led to a very intense relationship, which lasted until his death. He could be short-tempered, but working with him took me closer than ever before, and with great intensity, to the personalities of Schumann and Beethoven. He gave me so many ideas about voicing and left-hand-right-hand balance, on character, rhythm, and tempo. I think about him every day when I sit down at the keyboard." Early in his career, Ansnes liked to publicize his recordings by staging photo opportunities in unexpected places, with a grand piano on a snowy mountaintop to publicize his Greek, and drowning the same long-suffering instrument in a swirling torrent to publicize his presentation of Mussorgsky's pictures at an exhibition. He doesn't yet have a plan to publicize his current recording of Dvorak's seldom-performed poetic tone pictures, but he's vociferously campaigning for this hour-long solo piano cycle to be recognized as the masterpiece it most definitely is. How has the pandemic changed him? His answer is instant. "I don't take musical performances for granted anymore. Norway wasn't closed down all the time, and during the pandemic I could still play for live audiences, if sometimes for only 20 people. Every time I found myself in a good hall with a good piano, it brought tears to my eyes. I treasure such moments now." He has 3 children, one aged 11 and twins aged 8. "It was a good thing to have more time together, but I worry about the future for my children, and my heart goes out to all the young talent being denied the things young people normally expect from life. The security we used to have about the future is gone." Where will the tour go after the proms? "Everywhere except Russia." At the time of my writing this article, he was about to play in the Polish town of Katowice, and he'd love to play in Ukraine. "I find this threat of war hanging over us terribly depressing. The only thing we musicians can do for now is show compassion, hoping that our music can mean something symbolically. We just have to hope that there is enough good in the world to counteract the evil." In the BBC Music magazine for July of 2022, we get to interview rising star violinist Anna Ehm. "Where were you born?" "Daejeon, South Korea." "What would be your career highlight?" winning the 10th Michael Hill International Violin Competition and recording my debut album of Brahms, Tchaikovsky, Clara Schumann, Paganini, and Grieg mid-pandemic as part of the winner's prize. Who are your musical heroes? The array of emotions you can experience in a single moment listening to the music of Brahms is astonishing. I cannot imagine this extreme depth of feeling being communicated in any other art form. What would be your dream concert? Performing Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante with violist Tabea Zimmermann and the Berlin Philharmonic. In the BBC Music Magazine for August of 2022, Terry Blaine reviews a new recording of the complete songs of Barber. Deutsche Grammophon's classic survey of Barber's songs has ruled the catalog for 3 decades, but its dominance may be over. This new resinous collection not only includes 19 songs never recorded before, but uses 10 different singers to Gigi's 2, Cheryl Studer and Thomas Hampson, adding valuable variety to the overall listening experience. And what an experience it is! Even from the earliest opus numbers, Barber's songs ripple with acuity and emotional intelligence, with no hint of a young composer struggling to find his feet. Bass William Thomas's plangent take on Opus 2 with Rue My Heart Is Laden, and tenor Nicky Spence's risingly intense Rain Has Fallen from Opus 10 are 2 striking examples of how tellingly Barber aligned words and music from the outset. Quite how punctiliously Barber stitched sound, rhythm, and syntax together is underlined in Nuvoletta, where he sets a snapshot story from James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, a lilting waltz, droll quotations from Wagner's Tristan und Isolde, pointillistic depictions of tears dropping at twilight. Barber glides easily from one dream image to another, dexterously flipping idioms and playfully inflecting the Joycean neologisms sfumus deliasinus and engausments. Soraya Maffi is the intelligent soloist. Hermit Songs is the major cycle here, and again this recording really hits the mark. In the opening, At St. Patrick's Purgatory, soprano Mary Bevan conveys a sense of spiritual crisis without resorting to squally melodrama. Church Bell at Night has a limpid clarity with just a touch of sensuality, while The Heavenly Banquet is puckish but shorn of bluster. Bevan's The Desire for Hermitage closes the cycle in ideally ruminative fashion. Soprano Samantha Clark's alluring Sure on This Shining Night and baritone Julien Van Mallet's sentient Dover Beach, supported by the Nevada String Quartet, are other highlights. But almost any song on this absorbing issue can be listened to with joy. Among the premier recordings, there are riches, too. In the affectionately antiquarian The Words from Old England, and the solemn Fantasy in Purple to a poem by Langston Hughes. Both are sonorously delivered by the dark-toned bass William Thomas. Barber sets French beautifully, too, in the alluring La Nuit and Au Clair de la Lune. Both songs recall Poulenc, and soprano Soraya Maffi is again a sensitive soloist. Even the evergreen Knoxville Summer of 1915 is presented in unfamiliar guise, using a version Barber himself made for piano accompaniment. Losing the orchestra in Knoxville is theoretically a setback, but is more than compensated by the immediacy of Nick Spence's evocative interpretation. Dylan Perez's pianism is consistently insightful without obtruding. A tall order for any accompanist. and his curating of the entire project is masterly. The sound quality is excellent, engineer Adam Binks striking an ideal balance between voice and piano. These two discs undoubtedly set a new benchmark in Barber's vocal music, and every art song lover should have them. There's still time for a few questions we wanted to ask this recording's artistic coordinator, the pianist Dylan Perez. Question: how did this project take off? It was a lockdown idea, and it was my first time putting a project like this together. It took a while getting the funding and learning about recording venues and all of that, so it was really a new experience for me. I wanted to learn how to do it all, as well as giving a platform to lots of young British singers who needed a bit of work at that time, showcase their voices and this really fabulous repertoire. Question: tell us about your program choices. Did you want to match voices to songs? I know all the singers quite well, so I knew everybody's voices, but I went through the texts and the range of the songs and tried to figure out who would shine the best in each set and in each of the posthumously published songs as well. That was tricky, as nobody knew what any of those posthumous songs sounded like, so I had to play through them and just kind of guess. Question: was there a favorite discovery among them? Probably Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening. It just has this magical quality about it that I think is rarely achieved, and there's a real stillness to the music that is difficult to realize. Question: did you get to know Barber better through curating this? I was a big Barber fan before this. I've always loved the Nocturne and Vanessa, the string quartet, and the violin concerto, and I had played quite a few of his published opus numbers before I recorded them. So I knew quite a few of the pieces, but I wanted to put my stamp on them and just see what would happen. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, with generous support from Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me next week for Classical Music Connection.